Welcome back to the Lunch and Roost Cycling Podcast with Benji Nyson here for Tour de Suisse Stage 5 Recap. Our show is brought to you by our show partner, Lacole. They produce performance cycling apparel. They've got the Lacole McLaren Project Aero collaboration live on the site now, as well as summer bundles for all of you in Europe and North America. But this Tour de Suisse Stage 5, speaking of the mountain air, we hit the hardest climb of the race today, 176Ks from Stade to Lurkebad, and it's the Erschmatt climb that would break up this race. Pretty easy before that. 8Ks, 8.4%, intermediate sprint at the bottom, then a descent, then a drag to the line, 4.1Ks at 7% to the finish. No high altitude, but two difficult climbs back to back. GC, Mathieu Van der Poel wearing the leader's jersey going into this stage, narrowly ahead of Alaphilippe, with Carapaz a little bit further behind. But speaking of the man, Benji, he decided to defy convention as he does today, as usual.
Yes, certainly. We had a breakaway at the start of the stage, and that breakaway included Mathieu Van der Poel. Next to that, Bernsteiner Samitier, and again, Claudio Imhoff, I think the third time he's in the breakaway. I think the last time I had seen a leader's jersey in the breakaway was Greg Van Avermaet in the Tour de France a few years ago. It probably happened in a few other races, but I just don't recall them so vigorously as the one from Van Avermaet, because Belgium, you know, okay. Anyway, that breakaway did have a solid lead. I was a bit surprised that they gave him up to like 4 minutes with a group with Van der Poel in it. But then again, let's be real, looking at the final, he must have had miracle days to actually pull this off and win the stage. And I didn't really see that happening personally, but I was hoping for it a tiny bit. But a breakaway eventually got caught near the bottom of the big climb of the day. So the third KOM, which is that Erschmatt climb you mentioned earlier.
They dropped him. Bernstein and Samitier dropped Van der Poel, I think.
Yeah.
Or did he give up? I don't know. Maybe he just wanted some camera time going back to the peloton. But yeah, when did Bernstein and Samitier get brought back?
Well, basically near the bottom of the final proper, well, not the final climb, but the second last one, the Erschmatt. And that was when Jumbo started moving up to the front of the group. And I think they had three people at the front at a certain point. And one of them was punching towards the bottom of the climb. The second one was trying to set something up. And then there came an attack at the bottom of that Erschmatt climb by Antoine Tolhoek, Hastings' 14-year-old son. And I didn't see it coming.
I was somewhat surprised because, remember, Ineos have got still Dennis and Dunbar left. And, yeah, it's an aggressive move to attack so early. There's other teams with more who need to play their cards earlier on. And, yeah, they attacked really early. Eventually, Tolhoek sort of sat just up the road. There was another attack from Latour as Rowan Dennis started pacing. A little bit steep, perhaps, for Rowan Dennis. And then, yeah, Latour attacked, got brought back. And then it was Esteban Chavez attacking. Now, he did this in the Volta Catalunya stage four, that's right. He attacked, and it was when Carapaz was pacing. But he wasn't a threat on GC, so he was allowed to sort of have a 30 to 40-second leash. A similar thing happened today, although I don't think Ineos had much of a choice in it. It was Eddie Dunbar pacing. I don't think he could have brought him back any quicker. In the group with Dunbar was his teammate Carapaz, Fuglsang, Schuckmann, Alaphilippe, Woods, Uran, Chavez teammate Lucas Hamilton, as well as Sam Omen for Jumbo-Visma. So they eventually catch Tolhoek, that group. Chavez is sort of lingering up the road, and then he crested the climb first, and then there's a tricky descent. Where did Fuglsang attack, Benji? Was that like through a little series of houses before the crest? It was kind of reminded me of the bit where sometimes Nibali attacked Fuglsang. No, when Nibali attacked Pino in Lombardia, when it gets really narrow before the last descent.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. It looks like that. It was a bit of a village just before the top of this climb, but it also reminded me, now that we're comparing it to other races, we once had a Vuelta where there was a breakaway battle between Nikita Stalnov and Benjamin King, and Stalnov got dropped in between such houses as well, if I recall correctly. And that's what it reminded me of, but hey, anyway, let's continue on with the race. Fuglsang did that attack, and he was still pretty far behind Chavez at that point. Did we see some reactions by others? I think we saw some reactions. I think Uran tried to respond, and then we had Carapaz go to the wheel of Dad and Alaphilippe in the wheel of Carapaz. But I felt like Carapaz was waiting a tiny bit. He was trying to get other people to do the dirty work there. And I even thought, oh, is he okay? Because he's dropping through the group while the others are trying to counter this attack and so forth. So I was getting a bit, oh, Jaguar, are you okay? But yeah, eventually the group came back together except for your boy Fuglsang, who was up the road a tiny bit and was trying to bridge towards Chavez in that descent. But going into the descent, Chavez, well, he decided to park he decided to park on a driveway. Let's be real. Federal trespassing or something? Is that a thing?
I don't know what the laws are in Switzerland. Yeah, it was pretty lucky, actually. So it's a left-hand bend, and he hits the apex, and there was a change in road surface. And he seems either he brakes or it bucks him. I'm not sure what, but it throws him straight, and he goes straight instead of turning left, and that throws him into this driveway. And the driveway, very luckily for him, there was one there, perfect tarmac. It acted as, you know, on a long highway descent, they have the off ramps for trucks that have brake failures, sort of cool their brakes. They go off to the side and it like goes up against to actually naturally brake them. It was basically that. And it braked Chavez safely, and he was able to turn around and start his descent again. Whereas if that was a wall, he's crashing a lot more heavily. So yeah, but it kind of threw him. It literally threw him, that apex, and then he lost a lot of time to Fuglsang, who caught him on the descent, started working with him, and eventually dropped him as it started to rise at the end. So, you know, short valley where they did work together, but then rises up to look about 4K, 7%. It is Fuglsang territory, a man who's won Lombardia last year. He's won Liège-Bastogne-Liège, perfect sort of climb for him. And behind, it was Jumbo Visma pacing. Alaphilippe had done a little bit of the work, but it was Tolhoek who'd attacked really early, too early, and then he was pacing for Sam Omen. Were you surprised to see that, Benji, given that you've got, you know, everyone else in that group is more favoured in the GC to win this race than Sam Omen?
I think you can look at it in multiple perspectives. First of all, you can look at it firstly as they're trying to reduce the gap between them and the front of the race, but also you can look at it as they're trying to expand the gap between them and the people behind them to try and secure a top 10 positioning with Sam Omen and perhaps Tolhoek if he stays up there as well. But then again, if you play it tactically, you can force other people to do the work, because you're going to end up with a situation if you don't go to the front that somebody else will take over or attacks will follow. And I think that perhaps they tried to do it to avoid attacks because they knew they weren't going to be able to follow the moment that attacks would happen. That's the only like idea that I could give them. But from a tactical perspective, you try to force your competitors, even if you've got the upper hand numerically, if they're so much better, they need to do the work. And also because they've got
more to lose. And if they attack, then maybe use Tolhoek and Omen to try and they can go to their wheel. I mean, it's not going to be easy, but then sit on them. You don't have to work with them. You can say, yeah, oh, I got the other guy behind. I guess you could do that as well. I think pacing Carapaz back to Fuglsang almost guaranteed what eventually did happen, which was El Jaguar de Tulcán jumping out of that group. He'd been pretending like he had bad legs or sitting at the back waiting. Schachmann had been doing much of the same, but he wasn't able, whereas Alaphilippe had been doing a lot of the work. And Alaphilippe was really, really twitchy and nervous. He was going back to the car, asking for a bottle. He nearly chopped himself on the back of Carapaz's back wheel. He was doing the things, you know, when in Liège last year, he was acting weird, and then he was acting a bit funny and getting really sort of stressed and irritated. But yeah, Carapaz attacked, and when we saw that, no one could respond.
Uran thermonuclear?
I think so, because Schachmann had been sitting on. Maybe not actually, because he didn't drop Fuglsang when he went. He got to Fuglsang's wheel and then decided to attack past him, but Fuglsang got back to his wheel. If he straight dropped Fuglsang, then we can attribute it to the thermonuclear moniker. But it's more just El Jaguar eating his prey, rain, hail, or shine, and yeah, gets into a group with Fuglsang, and they start working together, because Fuglsang, they're both 38 seconds behind on GC or so. or Carapaz not as far back on GC. And yeah, what did you think of Alaphilippe behind Benji? Do you think, is this like another example of where he's a lot of pressure's put on him to pace when he's not even actually a better GC rider in this sort of race than Uran or on this climb, than Uran or Hamilton or Woods or who else is there, Schachmann?
In all honesty, I'm not underestimating Alaphilippe at this point, because from what we saw, from what his schedule was the last few months, I feel like he's subtly straight up aiming for GC at the Tour, and it wouldn't surprise me if that's his actual proper goal. And looking at how he's climbing right now, I'm saying he's doing pretty damn good of a job at the moment. So he's looking at a potential top 10 in the Tour from what I can see right now, potentially more if we see even more. But today, he's in a group where if people bring him to Fuglsang and Carapaz, then Alaphilippe is likely going to win the stage. The problem is that these other GC riders need to realize as well that if they don't pace, they're losing GC anyway. So you might as well pace a bit, because like, I feel like it would be much more beneficial, because at a certain point, Alaphilippe would come to the front with like 1K to go and he'd be like, okay, yeah, if you guys don't want to win, then I might as well just pace a tiny bit till the line. So I think that there could have been much more understanding in the group. They've got the same goal, GC, and Alaphilippe could have an extra thing in that, but Alaphilippe winning the stage shouldn't stop a rider like Uran to somewhat keep on pacing and so forth, because you're reducing your possibilities of doing well in GC. That's my take on it, at least. Yeah. Definitely the last kilometer, let's be real.
They lent on him a lot, and you saw that at the finish. Alaphilippe was very tired, but in that finish, Carapaz and Fuglsang went there together. Fuglsang took the front with 250 meters to go. It's uphill. They're still climbing. So 250 meters is a long way out. And he took the front, basically let out Carapaz. Carapaz got a good snap, good kick, especially uphill. I was surprised to see Fuglsang do that, because he's not a good sprinter as Carapaz. And yeah, what we expected happened. He let out Carapaz. Carapaz waited, and then jumped out of his wheel when he wanted to in the last 30 meters and won pretty comfortably, despite doing probably the lion's share of the work on the last climb, as well as bridging. Bridging with the big attack on that climb as well. So dominant victory for Carapaz. Eddie Dunbar did a good job, and he came back after the descent as well. But still, it's not like the Ineos team put this on a platter for Carapaz. He had to do a fair bit of work himself too. And he achieved the double here with the stage victory ahead of Carapaz at the same time. Woods takes 4 burner seconds, third, 39 seconds back. So pretty big gap. Hamilton fourth, Uran fifth, Schachmann sixth, Alaphilippe seventh, Pozzovivo eighth, and then Chavez loses 10 seconds, then Oermen and Tolhoek 10th and 11th. GC now, Carapaz is the second part of what he achieved, goes into the leader's jersey, 26 seconds ahead of Fuglsang and 33 seconds ahead of Alaphilippe, and Schachmann fourth, same position, then Uran, Hamilton, Woods, Oermen, Chavez, Pozzovivo round out the top 10. Tomorrow's stage has the most climbing in it. It's got the
Dennis climb. Sorry.
It is. No, you're right. Benji's 100% right. And this is the one. It opens with San Gotardo out the gate, 8.3K, 7.1%. It's short too, 130K. So then a long descent valley. And then this is the Dennis climb of this year's Tour de Suisse, the Emmanuel climb, 18.2Ks, up to 2,000 meters or so, 5.6%. Absolutely perfect for him. Then descent and then like a drag. Again, if Dennis makes it over that climb, you won't be able to attack Ineos. It's 7Ks at 3.5% with a flat finish. Who's going to win this stage, Benji? The thing I'm going to be most watching is Alaphilippe on these long climbs, particularly if Dennis is setting a hard pace, although I don't think he will. I think he'll be keeping it together as opposed to sort of attacking last year on the Stelvio. What do you think? Brake got any chance?
Nah, I don't think so. I feel like Dennis should keep it together on the climb, but also there's so many riders here that are likely still going to try and go on the attack earlier on the climb. Like Chavez tried it today, but he's probably going to try it tomorrow again, because in GCs he's like 2.5 minutes down. So he needs to try from afar unless he's happy with a ninth position in GC. So there's a lot of riders that still have to do with a lot of stuff. This is also not the final mountain stage, which means that some might be saving energy. But I'd expect some action, and I hope that GC wins. Let me say it like that. In regards to who could potentially take it, Alaphilippe, yeah, but also perhaps like Woods, I don't know. His sprint against Alaphilippe at LBL was not optimal at all, but this is a very different situation. And after such a climbing stage, perhaps Woods could actually take it home. And it's not like the descents are like very steep, which means that his descending factor, while it was good today, will likely not play too much of a part tomorrow either. So I think Woods would be a name I'd love to say, although most likely I see Alaphilippe taking this one home personally.
I see Carapaz, he has a good chance for a back-to-back win tomorrow. I think the GC gaps are still so small that Ineos got to keep this race really tight. You can't let a guy take 30 seconds because, you know, you think he'll bring it back. I think got to keep it super tight. I don't know where Pernsteiner is on if there was someone to win from a break, Pernsteiner would be the sort of man. He'd have to have a lot of help and he'd have to have the right combination of the teams.
Tom Dumoulin? Yeah. This is his kind of climb too, you know? Like steady gradient?
Maybe if he goes in. Yeah, I mean, Dumo in the break, I think it'd be good to see that. Go in the break. The problem is the climb at the start. Like, you can't get Van Hooydonk in, you know, in a group with you because there's a long valley as well. That's why this stage is difficult for the break because you want to get – maybe they want the break to go on that descent and then you can get Van Hooydonk and Dumoulin with Ternus and then, get a nice
game. But this could offer an opportunity for Jumbo to try and play something tactically because you've got that climb at the start. You've got the option to put Dumoulin in the breakaway there, but also you got the option of trying something with either Omen or Tolhoek. Putting them in the breakaway, it will likely neutralize the break from the inside. But if you got Dumoulin pacing there for the entire descent and the first section of the Lukmanier pass, you've got a chance to try and throw this to the Swiss around, and it'd be pretty fun to see. So yeah, perhaps I'm just hoping that the race gets opened up on the first climb already, which is a bit unlikely.
I think Ineos are a little bit vulnerable. Dennis, it'll suit him more tomorrow rather than the steeper climb today, for sure. But, you know, Golash and Al, not as good on these sort of climbs. Luke Rowe, great in the valley, but maybe not the climb. So Dennis will have to do a big shift on that long climb as well as Eddie Dunbar because Sivakov looks absolutely terrible. I think I don't know where he finished today, but he wasn't
able. Oh, he's here. I forgot about him for 5 days.
It's weird. He did the crash in the Giro, then they've thrown him into the Tour de Suisse, and he had a fractured collarbone, I think, in the Tour de Suisse. And he's doing the Vuelta. I don't know what, like he's nowhere near proper race shape. So
yeah,
I think they just hoped he'd be an extra climber to help Carapaz or to give him some race days like Dumoulin, but he certainly won't help. So Dennis and Dunbar are the men for Carapaz, and he'll need both of them to pull a big shift tomorrow. Or maybe he goes on the offense. Who knows? He's the sort of guy he is. But it should be a good stage tomorrow. And, Tour de Suisse is really heating up. I want to see. Let's see what Alaphilippe can do on these longer climbs, whether he's just hanging on or whether he's fresh for the finish. Anything else from the Tour de Suisse, Benji, that's caught your eye?
Not directly. I think that's roughly about it for this stage. I had a question, but I totally forgot about it. So I guess I'm going to have to keep it for... I got it. Whenever we see Domenico Pozzovivo on his bike, he always seems to be leaning like sideways on his bike, like resting more on his right arm than his left arm. Is that like a leftover from an injury or no clue? If anybody knows, just drop it below because I'm genuinely curious.
Yeah, I think Pozzo... I'd love to see him just commit to going. His last stage win was Tour de Suisse, stage 6, actually. So that's a nice – I'd love to see Pozzovivo win, actually, tomorrow. But, yeah, that was his last win, the stage 6 of Tour de Suisse in 2017, a descent finish. But I think it might be difficult for him tomorrow. I'd love to see him just commit for going for stages, to be honest. He's won three World Tour races in his career.
He can win so much more.
He's still a really good climber, still top climber. He's in this sort of group, but – he's nowhere near good enough to really compete for GC at any Grand Tour or even, yeah. So, but anyway, that's just a sort of inefficiency that seems to regularly occur in World Tour cycling and perhaps another off-season topic. But now we'll on to the Tour of Slovenia if you're listening on podcast players, or that's a separate video on YouTube if you're watching there. Welcome back to the Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast with Benji Nyson here for Tour of Slovenia Stage 2 recap. We'll have some highlights in this video for you as well if you're watching on YouTube. Thanks to Lacole for supporting this show. This Stage 2 is 148Ks with two longer climbs, 5K 7% in the middle of the stage, and the Svetina climb, 5.2K 7.7%, then a descent, and then a punch to the finish, 2Ks at 7.2%. Benji and I, naively, probably with our World Tour hats on, were saying, oh, it'll probably be a puncher finish and, you know, like most likely be a group and then a sprint at the end for Pogačar and Ulisi. Well, Pogačar showed his cards in this stage today. But before we get to Pogačar's dominance, there was a breakaway that opened up today with one familiar name in it, Benji.
Yes, certainly. We had Dan Bigum in it. We also had some other riders in there. Ganishev, Molly, Banaszek. We had Arais Kuznetsov, the guy that got, I think, third in Gent-Wevelgem, the one Peter Sagan won in 2016, I think. Crazy ride by him at Katusha that day. But yes, indeed, the most notable name that people might know is Dan Bigum, because he's also, next to being a cyclist, sometimes commentator, co-commentator on, I think, GCN. And next to that, also works for Jumbo, if I recall correctly, as an aero guy. But those are the majority of the information I have on the guy. Nonetheless, the breakaway wasn't going to really play a big role here today. We had two teams in the peloton really showing control. Perhaps 2.5 teams, I'd say, because UAE was pacing a lot. We had Bahrain pacing a lot. But also UNOX showing towards the front a tiny bit before the intermediate sprint happened on today's stage. And it seemed like they were planning something for that, right?
Yeah, UNOX, they're always active. You've got to respect those guys. They animate races, particularly in Belgium they have this year. Maybe it didn't pay off for them today. they had the break and check pretty early, everyone, and then they were like, okay, let's slow down. We don't want to catch them too early. But they did before that last intermediate sprint. Now, I don't know if Bahrain were going to get Bauhaus points or what was happening. He was definitely on the front. But Bahrain pacing after UNOX paced into the base of this climb, which is 5.2Ks at 7.7%, it split the peloton. No one was really expecting it, or maybe just someone lost the wheel. It was narrow and a few twists into that Svetina climb. And we basically had a group with Bauhaus, Tratnik, Pogačar, and yeah, that was pretty much, and Vergard Steker Langen, the Norwegian as well, I think. So he was in that group. And so they've pretty much, Bahrain created a perfect situation for Pogačar. Bauhaus promptly drops, of course. I mean, he's a sprinter. So we have a group of three on this climb at the base of the Svetina climb. Pogačar, Steker Langen pacing him, obviously, selflessly, and then Tratnik sitting on. And Tratnik's obviously looked outstanding in the Giro climbing and in Flèche, but today he didn't have as good legs. And maybe he's a bit tired, or understandably tired from that long, he's had a long period of racing. And he dropped earlier than I expected, maybe because the pace was very high on the Svetina. But yeah, he dropped off that pace. So we've got Pogačar going clear, Steker Langen's gone, but Pogačar didn't go full straight away on the Svetina, not straight away. We could see the camera cut back to Micah and Ulisi. Now, I thought, I had some gut feeling told me, just because this was a similar stage to the ones Ulisi's done well at in the past in Slovenia, I was like, maybe they go for Ulisi today, UAE. And that's what seemed to be happening. Micah was on the radio, Pogačar seemed to ease up a bit, and Micah was bringing back Ulisi to the Pogačar. So then, but they're bringing with them Matteo Sobrero, the Italian 24-year-old out of contract. I mean, if you want to sign a talented guy, yeah, a good TT, well, maybe that's a separate topic for the offseason, pencil his name down. They're bringing him with them. So they bring him back to Pogačar. We've got three UAE, Pogačar, Ulisi, Micah. And we're thinking, okay, business as usual, Sobrero as well on the back. Micah's going to pace, and then we'll set up Ulisi for the stage when we'll drop Sobrero later. But that's not what happened. Pogačar just decided to attack. I remember when I did the preview video. This is because if you remember that Vlasov, Chavez, Pogačar, Ulisi situation, remember what happened there. Pogačar gave the go ahead to Ulisi to attack at the end of that climb. Well, he's never won a Tour of Slovenia stage. He probably doesn't, you know, if Ulisi goes up the road, he could gain a minute on GC or something. I think he wants to win GC here. So he was like, nah, I'm attacking today, drops all those guys. Those two then sit on Sobrero, who paces them at a good pace on the climb, and Pogačar goes clear, gets a 35-second gap very quickly. I think chasing behind, Benji, it was James Shaw on another UAE rider. He was being paced by the UAE rider as well. Mohorič.
Alonso.
Was, Yeah, Polonis is probably a good, the right one. Moric was coming back as well, but he got dropped pretty early on the climb. It seemed like, it's weird, Benji, like Bahrain pacing into the base and then Moric being completely out of position. It's kind of surprising to me. I mean, what could Bahrain's plan have been today? And if you were Bahrain, would you have chosen this climb as the one to try and attack Pogačar at the base?
I think that it's weird that they went all out just before the climb. And I think it perhaps is a bit of a situation where they're trying to put pressure on UAE before the climb happens and to make sure that the attacks that UAE does on the climb are less effective than the ones they had initially planned to do towards Bahrain. But I think the idea should not be to have Moric attack on the climb. I think the idea should be to have him attack in the descents. I think this Fatina descent is also one he descended on and he attacked on a few years ago. I do expect that an attack from this team is more likely to come with Moric on the descent than on the uphill section, and that Trotnik perhaps was the rider they were going to try and keep up there as well on the climbing section. But again, his legs were not there on the day, at least not the ones we've been seeing in previous weeks. But yeah, I don't think we can tell an entire story about it. There was one rider much better than all the others in this race when it comes to the climbing, and whatever Bahrain would have done today would not have been enough to get Pogačar off that top step. So does it really matter?
I think it does. I think it does matter because what Benji just mentioned, it came to life in reality in that when Pogačar goes over the top of the climb clear, he's got like a minute 12 gap. That's such a big gap that even when he took the descent pretty cautiously, it wasn't as wet that descent. Maybe he knows it as well. But behind, Sobrero drops the two UAE guys easily, Ulissi and Micah. And then Moric, who was way back, catches them on the descent and then goes past, and they catch up to Sobrero in this sort of 7K valley before the final climb. And then Sobrero and Moric start working in the valley trying to put pressure on the UAE guys. So it seemed like the best point in the race, if they did want to put pressure on UAE, who do have the strongest team by far here, particularly on the climbs, was on the descent, was on the valley. And if they wanted to make a difference with Moric, it would have been, let's hope this climb is slow.
True.
Let's hope the climb's slow. And then if Pogačar attacks over the top, gets 15, 20 seconds, maybe Moric can even catch that back up at the end. But anyway, Pogačar went clear, solo, did the climb on his own, the last 2K, 7% climb in front of all the home fans, honoring the race. And he's looking in good shape for the tour, winning this stage easily. A minute and 22 seconds ahead of the chasers, who were basically then Micah. He had such a big gap that Micah led out Ulissi on the last climb, but he actually got beaten by Moric in the uphill sprint for Bahrain victorious. So not a UAE 1-2. So it's Pogačar, Moric second, Ulissi third on the same time with Sobrero. Fantastic effort from him. Then Kangert, Shaw, Micah, Carboni, who we saw in the Giro, Jonathan Lastra, and then Polonce makes up the top 10. But yeah, anything else to say apart from just Pogačar pure dominance in this stage, Benji?
Yeah, not really. I think that was a fun stage to watch. I think that we were kind of expecting. I think we mentioned yesterday that we thought about a strategy for UAE where they could attack with Pogačar on the climb and keep Ulissi for the final sprint. If it all comes together, it didn't come together anymore. So Pogačar takes it. And I think we're going to see a repeat of that on stage. Is it four? The climbing one? I think it is. I think there's no one in this peloton that can beat Pogačar on an uphill finish. So quite certain that he's going to be the winner there unless something odd happens. But that's about it for this stage. I think we need to take a look at the next one.
Yeah, it's always great to see the Tour de France champ just absolutely destroy a race, even if the competition isn't as good. Stage 3, 167Ks from Brezice to Krsko. And this is a sort of who's going to get over that final climb. 1K, 6.85%. Comes with 13Ks from the finish. It comes after the Sremic climb, 4.3Ks at 5.6%. I think Bike Exchange got a ride full for Rob Stannard here. He's who I think could take his first pro win. I think Bauhaus, they got to make him vulnerable on those two climbs and ride absolutely max there. Other quick finishes are Fellini and... Fellini and... I don't know if... who's your man... Aberastri, he can get over small hills, can't he, Benji?
Yeah, indeed. You were going to say Aramburu, right? But it's the wrong one.
Well, there's Aaron Brew here, but not the right one.
Yeah, it's joking, which is ready for some puns, to be honest. But yeah, Abed Astudi is my pick for this stage. I agree that Hill could cause trouble for a Bauhaus. I do still think that he's likely going to get over it. Wouldn't surprise me. But I am looking forward to a stage win by Abed Astudi. He was close on the first day, really close. And I think he's not that far away from Bauhaus when it comes to the sprinting ability. So with the ability of getting over climbs, that is better than Bauhaus, in my opinion, at least from what we've seen in the Vueltas before, then I truly believe that he could be the victor of this third stage in, well, not even going to pronounce it.
I'll be interested to see how Anil Kovski goes, whether he gets over the climbs okay, as well as Rory Townsend. He missed out on the first stage for Canyon DHB Sun God. I think Townsend's supposed to be quite quick. I'll be interested to see how he goes, as well as, yeah, I think it's a really good opportunity for Rob Stannard. And they got the team, Edmondson, Kanga, Callum Scottson, Andre Zeiss-Buley. That's a team that should be able to put some pressure on Bauhaus on these low, sort of shallow climbs, as well as the man, the myth, the legend, Restrepo, who he's either in the race and you know, or you don't even know he's there. But yeah, that was the Tour Slovenia Stage 2 recap. GC pretty much looks over already, but we always knew that was likely to be the case because Pogačar is just a step above everyone here. And yeah, he's looking good for the Tour de France defense in a couple of weeks. But until the Stage 3 recap, ciao.